Okay, welcome everyone. This is Nicola Marzari speaking from Lausanne in Switzerland. That's where EPFL is, one of the two federal universities in Switzerland. And it's the first of three webinars that will be streamed. One is today, the next one is tomorrow at the same time, and the last one will be on Friday. These webinars are being recorded and they will be uploaded to the Learn section of the Materials Cloud. There are actually five panelists with me. They are all from the group, from the Theory and Simulation groups here at EPFL. Antimo Marrazzo, Marco Borelli, Marco Vanzini, Samuel Ponce, and Francesco Libbi. They will be monitoring the chat. We are so many that we cannot really have questions live, but you are welcome to write your questions into the chat. They'll capture those. We'll write the answer in a PDF file, and that will also be uploaded in the Learn section. So let me start. What is the goal of these three webinars? Well, the first one, the one of today, is dedicated to the fundamental of electronic structure and explaining to you what density functional theory is. The one of tomorrow is a very practical one, is what I call density functional practice, and it will be actually dedicated to understanding how you perform a calculation using what is called the total energy plane wave pseudopotential method. That is very popular these days in science and technology. And there will be also a handout for some quantum mechanical simulations that you could do on your own using an open source code, Quantum Espresso. And actually, there is even a virtual machine that you can download. So everyone, no matter what computer you have, if it's Windows, Linux, or Unix, you can just download the virtual machine and run the code in that environment. And then the third webinar on Friday will really be dedicated to the scientists that are interested in understanding what can be done with density functional theory, what are the properties that are accessible to density functional theory, how expensive they are to calculate, what are the properties that are not accessible to density functional theory, and we'll see a number of applications and a number of these challenges. If you're interested in all of this, and we might try to do some more, you're also welcome to subscribe. We'll keep a mailing list for these webinars. So here below is the link. You would just input your email, and that link you can find it in the news section and in the learn section of the Materials Cloud website. Okay, so let's get started. And I would suggest to the panelists, raise a hand or send me a message or even give me a call if something is going wrong, because I'll probably be focused on talking. So let me start with a very broad introduction about the relevance of density functional theory in science and technology. And I'll start from this. This is a paper that came out in Nature in October 2014. It was called the Paper Mountain, the top 100 papers. They looked at all the scientific, medical, engineering, biological literature, anything that has been published, and they looked at the articles that were most cited. One of these bibliometric exercises. And they went back to the 17th century, to the proceeding of the Royal Society, to today, 2014, and they looked at the 100 most cited papers. And you could imagine to find their DNA and cancer and major accomplishments, Nobel Prizes, but actually the field that was most represented with 12 most cited papers in those top 100 and two in the top 10, was actually density functional theory. That tells you what is really the impact of this kind of calculations in the entire world of science and technology. If you take physics and if you take the Journal of the American Physical Society, it's even more remarkable. This is an exercise that I did last year when I visited actually the APS headquarters. So I looked at, you know, physical review letters, physical review B, and so on and so forth. And these are the most cited papers in the entire history of the American Physical Society, so more than 120 years. And the one in red are all about electronic structure simulation. There are 18 of those, so you see the top 15. One is the Muller-Plessey paper about post-Hartree-Fock perturbation theory. Everything else is about density function theory. So you can see, you know, how relevant these calculations are, how pervasive, and that's why I just wanted to give this introduction to understand the fundamentals and to understand what can and cannot be done. These days, actually, there is a lot of optimism in the capability of using these calculations to predict the properties of materials, maybe before even experiments, or helping or accelerating experiments. You might have heard of the Materials Genome Initiative. I like this quote from Barron's. That's a US tech paper about a materials revolution where powerful simulation techniques increase the computing power, machine learning, will automate much of the discovery process. And this is actually, these are titles from some of the actually mostly Nature scientific journals. You see a lot of optimism about the capability of designing materials with simulations. I love this Gordon Research Conference title from a few years ago. Are experiments still necessary? And of course, the answer is yes. And actually, you know, we will not really invent any physical phenomena that is not already contained in density functional theory with these simulations. But this kind of simulation had a major impact earlier on in high pressure physics because it's so difficult to do experiments at high pressure. And actually, you know, our capabilities to describe condensed electrons are very good. So for us, it's very easy to turn the dial and, you know, have all of a sudden 500 gigapascal in our simulations. While in order to do a proper gasket for a diamond anvil cell, you really need to put an enormous amount of intelligence. And we can also explore, and you'll see examples, many different configurations. And so it becomes easy to try and see what a material would want to do at extreme conditions. And you'll see a lot of examples, especially on Friday, of the capability of density functional theory. Again, they are in part driven by the fact that the simulations these days are very affordable. I love actually this little movie that I did 10 years ago in Oxford. That's my Nokia Linux cell phone running Debian Linux. I installed Blast Lapack FFTW and I compiled Quantum Espresso, and you see it live in 45 seconds calculating the ground state electronic structure of silicon. Maybe the only important thing that has happened in the last 10 years, so that maybe few were imagining 10 years ago, has been, of course, the entrance into the field also of ideas, concepts, and tools from computer science. So that is data mining, machine learning. We'll mention that on Friday, is becoming a great accelerator, substituting also for quantum mechanical simulations. But first and foremost, this has been the great accelerator. Just if we look at the capacity of digital computing, you all know how remarkable it has been. This is the list that is made every 6 months by the top 500 conference of the most powerful supercomputer in the world. That's the number one. And you see when it's flat, it means it's the same that remains for several period of 6 months. And this red curve is a place where the US and China and Japan joust for attention. But both this red curve or the wooden spoon, you know, the last one in the list, the last computer, and even the aggregate capacity power of all the 500 computers in this list that sits, that is the blue line, they all sit on a fairly straight line that if I put together the latest data as a slope that corresponds to capacity doubling every 6 months. That means you can, you know, just not do anything, just sleep for 6 months, and after 6 months, your house, your wealth, your laboratory has doubled just because, you know, the capacity of digital computing. And if this was a real-world experiment, let's say that, you know, to make a very complex experiment, it would have taken you 1 year in 1988. Well, today, it will take you 1 second. So we have had a 32-million-fold increase in the past 32 years. And that's why these calculations that 20, 30 years ago were still exceedingly expensive to perform, and only few supercomputer centers can afford the computing power needed, these days are prevalent. And if you want, the focus is moving, in my opinion, from the hardware to the software. I put here two examples that are very dear to me because these are open source codes that we develop or co-develop. The Quantum Espresso code is a team of developers based in Trieste, in Udine, but also here at the PFL in the United States. The Vanier code is especially dear to me because it all started during my postdoc. But you see, these are the number of publications that say, let's say, Quantum Espresso produces every year. It's actually the most used open source code for materials. VASP is even more used. That's by now a commercial code, but it's really rooted in academia. And you see, we're talking about close to 3,000 papers in a year. There are actually very few scientific installations in the world that produce that amount of papers. Don't quote me and don't record this, but if you go to the CERN website, I did, I think, a year ago, in 2018, they had 900 papers and 900 preprints. And of course, you know, they have also a number of Nobel Prizes and super important science, but it's actually amazing how much science these open source tools empower, and it's science that can be distributed worldwide to everyone at no cost. So that's why I'm a strong believer in this model of doing science and this model of open computational science. Okay, this was my introduction. Let's now go into the topic of the tutorial. And first, just to make sure we are all on the same footing, I have to teach you quantum mechanics or refresh you the fundamental ideas of quantum mechanics. I'll take 5 minutes. I remember there used to be a beautiful show in London given by the reduced Shakespeare company. I think in 90 minutes they did all the plays of Shakespeare. So if they can do all of Shakespeare in 90 minutes, I think I can give you quantum mechanics in 5 minutes. And let's get started. And this is actually a very nice story. This is probably one of the shortest PhD thesis ever. This is Louis de Broglie in Paris at the beginning of the 20th century, figuring out that there is a fundamental constant of nature and a fundamental relation that tells us that objects that starts to have a very small mass, a very small momentum, start acquiring wave-like characteristics. So you see, de Broglie wrote is an equation that says everything in life, so it could be an electron, an atom, a basketball, myself, a Ferrari car, any object that has a certain momentum, mass times velocity p, as a wave-like character with a wavelength lambda that is established by this relation. The product of the wavelength times the momentum is equal to the Planck constant. In the international system, it's 6.6 times to the minus 34 joules per second. In the system of atomic units that we'll use later on, is a bit easier to remember, is just 2 times pi. What does this mean? It means that as you get lighter, as your momentum gets smaller, your wavelength gets larger. And now, of course, what happens is that if you're a car or a basketball or myself or even a virus these days, well, your wavelength is still very, very tiny. But as you go lighter and lighter, you go to a small molecule, you go to an atom, you go to a nucleus, well, this wavelength starts becoming larger and larger. And almost magically, when you skip from a proton to an electron that lasts, you know, factor of 1,800 times in the mass, what happens is that now lambda has become large enough that starts to be comparable between the distance between the atoms, that is of the order of a few angstroms. And all of a sudden, the wave-like characteristics of the electrons becomes relevant. And the wave-like characteristic of everything else that we encounter normally, even something as light as a proton, the nuclei, and, you know, more massive objects, are almost always irrelevant. They almost always is a caveat that I'll explain later on. But somehow, at the conditions of temperature and pressure at which we live, we are in a situation in which the wave-like behavior of electron is very important, and the wave-like behavior of everything else is almost always not important. But the issue is that if you behave as a wave, you start giving rise to diffraction phenomena. This is a very beautiful visualization of the wave function of an electron. You see that there's a certain typical wavelength going through a double slit opening. And you see as this electron goes through, well, it goes through not one of the openings, but it goes through two of the openings simultaneously. And actually, parts of this wave function, the left and the right parts, actually interfere constructively or destructively with each other. And so if I were to sit here and look at the wave function and measuring the electron on a detector given by this red line, I would actually see a modulation in the probability of finding the electron that comes from this interference phenomena. So if you want, quantum mechanics is very much about understanding the wave-like character of quantum objects with the right equation. And to get the right equation, well, we need to go to Switzerland. You know, this is, you know, one of my lovely stories. Special relativity was invented by Albert Einstein in 1905 in Bern. And quantum mechanics was also invented in Switzerland, in particular on the 27th of December, 1925. So Erwin Schrödinger, the Austrian physicist, used to leave everyone, wife, lover, and disappear for his Christmas holidays, typically at a Villa Arosa. Arosa is in the Italian-speaking part of Switzerland. Sadly, doesn't exist anymore. We don't know with whom he was spending the Christmas holidays. Maybe it's not so important. But certainly being in a beautiful place, and you'll see example later on, gets you inspired. And you see what he wrote in a letter, not in English, by the way, he was Austrian, so he would write in German, but I translated it for you. It says, at the moment I'm struggling with a new atomic theory. I'm very optimistic about this thing, and if I can only solve it, it will be very beautiful. And he was right to be optimistic. That's really the birth of quantum mechanics. And solving it is a different matter, and we'll try to see it. But what is this equation? Well, for one electron, this is the equivalent of the second law of motion of Newton. You know, that tells us how a macroscopic object moves in the presence of a force. So what is its acceleration? And for a quantum mechanical object, that is a wave, we are going to understand how the amplitude psi of the wave, and it's a little bit more complicated than a wave, so this is a complex amplitude, how that amplitude evolves in space and how it evolves in time with this time-dependent Schrödinger equation for only one electron, where the important terms are this second derivative, the Laplacian, is measuring what is the curvature of this wave function field. And then this is the external potential. Typically, it will be the Coulombic attraction that the electron feels with the nuclei. We'll discuss that. And you see what we relate here is the second derivative of the wave function, so derivative with respect to space, a potential that is just multiplying the wave function and in principle depends on position and on time. We'll see later, keep this in mind, we'll see later what happens when this potential does not depend on time or it's very slow. And this curvature and this effect of potential is related to the change in time of the wave function. Now, the first thing that you should notice is that this is much more complex than sending people to the moon, where we just have to integrate Newton's equation of motion. So we don't have to take into account for a particle just the position and the velocity of the position of or momentum as a function of time, so six scalar fields, but for an electron, for something that thanks to the Broglie relation is quantum, we need to understand what that amplitude is at every point in space and at every instant in time. So there is an information challenge that we'll describe later on that is very important and makes actually the solution of the quantum mechanics equation much more difficult. Now here, let me actually, as I said, make this simplification in which the potential does not depend, anymore on time. So we consider a potential that is static or it's changing very slow with time. So the dependence on T in V has disappeared. And so what happens is that we can actually make an ansatz. We can write the wave function through separation of variables as a position dependent, this could be R, a position dependent part, and a time dependent part, F. And if we put this ansatz into the time dependent Schrödinger equation, what we find out is that that equation is satisfied if the psi is such that its decomposition in phi and f satisfies these two differential equations. One for the space dependent part of the wave function, for the phi of r, and that is called the stationary Schrödinger equation, and another one that depends only on time. Now there's we have equation number one, the stationary Schrödinger equation, and equation number two. Equation number two is very, very easy to solve because it's going to be just an imaginary exponential for any value of e. So that f of t is actually present in the full wave function, but it's very trivial to find. And in general, it will not come into play into any observable for our systems, because when we calculate the expectation value of any operator in the form of psi h psi or psi a psi, that f term will cancel out because it will multiply itself as being the only time-dependent term, and we have the term and its complex conjugate, so it gives us a factor of one. So what is really important and what is really difficult, and even for one electron, will be a difficult differential equation to solve, is the number one equation, is the stationary equation. And again, here, what I've done, I've made this assumption that only electrons are the quantum mechanical objects that are interesting, and that even when we study, say, maybe a drop of water with all the molecules moving around, the potential that all those oxygen nuclei and all those hydrogen nuclei are generating as they move around, maybe this is a liquid droplet, is in any case reasonably slow, so we can actually neglect its time dependence. So this is what is called, in generic term, the adiabatic or Born-Oppenheimer approximation. Actually, these two terms mean two slightly different things. But basically, what we are thinking is that if capital R of I are the position of my nuclei around which the electrons are attracted and these nuclei are moving around, we really don't have to worry about, say, their velocity. And the electron, that is the wave function psi for the electron, always rearranges itself to solve the Schrödinger equation, or we'll see it later through the variational principle, to minimize the energy functional for that given configuration of the position. And there is my last, say, Swiss example, and it's the one of a cow. We have a lot of cows here, and it's a cow with the flies. This is actually due to Nicola Bonini in King's College. And the idea is that the cow is the nucleus and the flies are the electrons. And no matter how fast the cow might try to run, the flies that are much faster will always follow it as if nothing were to happen. And so the electron, no matter what the nuclei are trying to do, are going to follow them as if they had no velocity, because they can always rearrange themselves instantaneously at their ground state just because they are so light and so fast. Now, this adiabatic approximation is what we'll use for the entire tutorial, but let me give you actually a few examples where this are actually approximation that starts failing. This is actually a nice one. This is looking at something that you can measure very well. You can measure with Raman spectroscopy the vibrational frequency of certain phonons, in this case, zone center phonons in graphene. And what the calculation in different flavors would predict for those frequency as a function of doping in the Born-Oppenheimer approximation are given by this line, depending on the details of the calculation. But what happens as you dope the material, as you dope graphene and you look at those phonon frequency, is that you start to have a lot of very viscous electrons around the Fermi energy. And when you shake around the atoms and these electrons are being shaken around, they don't rearrange themselves instantaneously to the ground state. And so there starts to be a relevant time-dependent effect that you can only capture if you go beyond the standard adiabatic Born-Oppenheimer approximation. Other examples that are just interesting to mention and that are relevant is that, say, protons, so that is nuclei that are very light, you know, they are only, you know, 1,800 times heavier than an electron, might have some wave-like behavior. And here we are actually looking at how a proton goes back and forth between two water molecules. And the behavior and the barrier that it sees is different if that proton behaves as a classical particle, or if it behaves as it does, as a true quantum particle. So, and you see how the barrier in this case for this process, that admittedly was very tiny, but is reduced by a factor of 3. Another example that I like very much comes from the world of ferroelectrics. This is a perovskite, a strontium titanate. You see the titanium, the big cation here in the center. You see the oxygen atoms. And actually, there is a large difference in the polarization in this system as a function of temperature, not at high temperature where the system is paraelectric, but at low temperature where the system would, you know, look like it has a ferroelectric phase transition. But that ferroelectric phase transition is actually inhibited by the capabilities of the oxygen atoms to tunnel back and forth through the bistable two possible ferroelectric states, because they see a very shallow barrier, and so they behave as quantum particle. The oxygen cages tunnels between all possibilities, actually all six possibilities, and at the end you never see ferroelectricity. and strontium titanate behaves as what is called a quantum parielectric. Another favorite example of mine, this is Olaf here doing the experiment, is actually that, you know, if you're very good and you're able to cool down even a molecule as large as C60, this is, you know, the fullerene, the soccer ball molecule, well, you can see interference effects for the molecules going through a diffraction grating. That means that the molecule has not gone through that slit. It's like the double slit I was showing before as a classical object, but has gone through as a quantum object interfering with itself past the grating. Other examples, this will be very important. We'll see them on Friday. And in order to understand the thermomechanical properties of materials, that is, in order to understand how do they respond to temperature, how their lattice parameter changes, maybe they expand, maybe they become softer. In order to understand this, we need to understand how temperature populates the vibration of the atoms, and actually the vibrational degrees of freedom satisfy Bose-Einstein statistics, and that really means that at low temperature you struggle with the very small amount of energy that you have lying around at exciting, say, any of those harmonic oscillators. We'll see that in detail in their first excited states. So the material is unable to absorb a lot of heat, so its heat capacity is actually very low, and you see here the deviation from the Dulong and Petit law, from the equipartition of the temperature and all the possible degrees of freedom, that comes exactly because of quantum mechanic effects on the nuclei, and in particular the fact that the statistical mechanics of their vibration is not a classical Maxwell-Boltzmann statistical mechanics, but it is a Bose-Einstein quantum mechanics of indistinguishable bosons. The last example, we are looking at an atom. Here we have an atom in green that is impinging on a metal surface. We are looking at an atom that is electronegative, so it's happy to, you know, rip away an electron from the metal. This could be oxygen falling on aluminum. Maybe it's not an atom, maybe it's a molecule, an oxygen molecule. And here there is a fantastic animation of the atom falling on the metal surface. What is interesting now is looking at this curve, where on the y-axis I have the energy as a function of distance. So this was the distance here. So this is called a potential energy surface. We are looking at the energy of the system depending on the distance of the atom from the surface. And if the atom falls on the surface very slowly, what will happen is that for every instantaneous position of the atom, the electrons are in the lowest possible configuration. And so you'll see it later, there will be a crossing point where the empty LUMO of the atom starts to become degenerate with the Fermi energy of the metal. It was above it when the atom was more distant. As the atom comes closer, the LUMO starts to be degenerate with the work function, and then it's lower. So electrons move from the atom, from the metal to the atom, and they fill up that LUMO that becomes now the highest occupied level in that atom, although it's now well below the Fermi energy. And so what will happen, if you want, is the electronic configuration of the atom has changed, and so the form of the potential energy surface has changed. Maybe it has happened when it was here at this position here. What we had is that the electron was maybe harpooned, and we had all of a sudden a minus here, and the metal you could have considered M plus. So we have switched from this curve for the two neutral subsystem to this curve where we are looking at the negatively charged atom falling onto the surface that has lost an electron. But if you know, we had a jet of atoms that were very fast, well, maybe that what would happen is that rather than following this potential surface, it wouldn't give time to the electron to jump from the metal to the atom, and so it would happily stay on the same potential energy surface. That actually, at the minimum, it's even in a configuration where it could sort of decay into different configuration by creating an electron hole pair. These are all known adiabatic effects that can be extremely important, and for the time being, for today, we are not going to consider. So really, this is what we are going to consider for today. We are going to consider a collection of not only atoms, but in general, electrons and nuclei. So, you know, you can think everything you're looking, you know, it's made of atoms. When I see this, I see the dance of Shiva. I see all the very massive nuclei where all the mass, or you know, 99.9% of the mass sits, all the positive charge sits with the proton, and the electrons around wave-like. And if we want to describe the system in the adiabatic approximation, this is the Hamiltonian operator that we are dealing with. It has five terms. Three are actually quantum mechanical. They depend on the wave-like property of the electron. We'll see them in a moment. One is the simple, because it's what is called a one-body operator, is the quantum kinetic energy of the electrons. The second term has to do with the interaction of each and every electron with each and every nucleus. The third term is actually the difficult one, is the term where we consider the interaction of every electron with every other electron. Now, because the Coulombic interaction repulsion is a two-body term, but here is a two-body quantum mechanical term, this is what makes the Schrödinger equation for many electrons very difficult. And I've written them here explicitly. You see what we have is that the one-body quantum kinetic energy is just a sum of Laplacian. I switched to atomic units, so very conveniently in atomic units, h-bar is equal to 1. Remember, h is equal to 2 pi. The mass of the electron is equal to 1, so that h-bar square over 2m factor of the Schrödinger equation in the international system has thus become 1/2. And then what I take is the Laplacian with respect to every electronic coordinate in the many body wave function. We'll see that in a moment. And then what I have is that every electron, this I lowercase, is a sum for every electron. So every electron fills every nucleus. So this potential, this would be typically a Coulombic attraction that is centered at the capital Ri, where each of the nuclei I sits. And depending if it's a Coulombic attraction, it just depends on 1 over the distance. So it depends on 1 over the absolute value of that vector difference. So this is the electron nucleus interaction. It's still simple because every electron just fills an electrostatic potential coming from the point-like collection of nuclei. What is difficult is this. This is what makes life, in some ways, interesting, is the two-body term, where you see this is a way to sum. There is another way to sum where we could take 1/2 over all possible I or J. So we are taking all the possible two-body electron-electron interaction. You understand right away, if you have three electrons, you need to look at the distance between 1 and 2, and then 2 and 3, and you don't have to count 3 and 2 and 2 and 1, and sorry, you have also 1 and 3. So you have only 3 terms and not 6, and that's why you can either write it as a sum over all possible I and j with a factor of 1 half, or a sum over all possible I for j greater than I. But this is what makes life difficult and interesting. So, you know, think for a moment, if you are in a crowd, if you are in a movie theater, if you are in a classroom, suddenly now we are all separated. But no matter what, you know, there are 7 billion people. If we were all electron, as soon as one of the 7 billion people moves his or her hand, everyone feels it. So everyone feels everyone else, of course, with an intensity that decreases with distance. But this is what gives rise to the collective and correlated complexity of the many-body problem. The electrons feels instantaneously everyone else, and they readjust. And that's why I say correlation. If you take something as simple as a helium atom with two electrons, you would find that the probability of finding two electrons close by is actually much less likely than the probability of finding them far apart, because being close by is a very repulsive, you see there is a positive sign there, interaction. And so this correlation is actually something very subtle and very difficult to get, and some of the techniques that we'll see will only be able to capture that in part. But that's also what makes life interesting, so you don't get anything for nothing. The last two terms are very boring, but very important. You know, Tn is the classical kinetic energy of the nuclei. There is a big difference if the glass of water you are drinking is at 30 Celsius or 100 Celsius. In one case, you don't really feel well. In the other, you sort of feel much better. So it's not difficult to describe. It's just one half the mass times the square of the velocity of the nuclei, but could be very relevant if we are studying, say, again, our water droplet. And equally well, the electrostatic, because now these nuclei are not quantum, are just classical particles between the nuclei. If we want to understand if just a hydrogen molecule stays together, you know, we need to take into account the fact that the two nuclei repel each other, the electron repel each other correlated and quantum mechanically, the electrons are attracted to the nuclei, there is a quantum kinetic energy, and all these five terms will contribute to the Hamiltonian, and then to the energy, the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, that will tell me if this molecule wants to stay together, maybe at a certain distance, how much does it cost to stretch it, so what is its harmonic frequency, how much it costs to dissociate. So the blue terms are difficult, especially the electron-electron term is very, very difficult, and the black terms and the blue terms are easy. Now, first and foremost, the problem in going from one electrons to many electrons is actually an informational problem. I love this part. So, you know, what used to be a complex field, maybe not even at every instant, say we are just looking here at the stationary part of the wave function, but what was a complex field at every place in space for one electron now has become a complex field function of how many electrons we have. And Douglas Hartree, that we'll see it again, you know, took the example of an iron atom. Iron is nice. It's, you know, if a meteorite falls onto your head, if you're lucky, it's going to be made of iron. Is you know, one of the heaviest common elements that is produced in you know, nucleosynthesis inside stars. So if you take an iron atom, it has 26 electrons. So now all of a sudden, my wave function psi for this 26 electron is a function of 26 vectorial coordinates in three dimension, or if you want, is a function of 78. I've multiplied it by three scalar coordinates. So it would be x1, y1, z1, x2, y2, and so on and so forth. So how can we store, say, on a computer, a complex field? So the amplitude psi, that is a complex number, it typically needs 8 bytes, 16 bytes in double precision, as a function of those 78 scalar coordinates. And Hartree said, well, let's really make a very pathetic approximation where we slice the little box where my iron atom lives in 10 slices. So I just need to give, 10 values for x1, 10 values for y1, 10 values for z1, and so on and so forth. How many numbers do I have? Well, you understand that if I have an electron, I have to give 1,000 complex numbers, because x1 can take 10 values, y1 can take 10 values, z1 can take 10 values. So one electron is 1,000 possibilities, 1,000 complex number, piece of cake these days. Two electrons starts to be 1,000,000. Three electron is already more complex, depending if you are American or English. You could call it 1,000,000,000, or maybe we need to go to 4 electrons to get 1,000,000,000s, but 10 to the 3rd, 10 to the 6th, 10 to the 9th, 10 to the 12th. By the time we have 26 electrons, we have 10 to the 78 possible entries. That I think is more than the number of atoms in the universe. So even for a humble iron atom, we don't have the capability to represent this very complex object. And this is what kills us, and that's why we need to find better ways. We will not see them in this webinar. So there are stochastic approaches like quantum Monte Carlo that tries to capture in statistical ways all these complexities. And there are systematic approaches based on different perturbative expansions like full configuration interaction that tries to capture this complexity. But you can see how, the full accuracy is very elusive here. So how do we make progress? Well, we use the fact that every time we have a differential equation, we have a variational principle, and that's very useful and that's very powerful. So here I defined my functional. What is a functional is a relation that eats, in this case, a function or our wave function psi as input, and gives us a number, in this case a real number, as output. So this is the energy of our system as a function of what the wave function psi is defined as the expectation value. This is Dirac bracket notation. If we were in a simple, scalar vectorial case, Hilbert space, it would be psi star h psi integrated. And just for the sake of convenience, we have not even normalized the wave function. The integral of psi star psi, since that psi star psi is the probability of finding the electron or that electronic configuration somewhere, when you integrate it over all the possibilities, needs to be equal to 1. Here, we don't even ask for that because we just put the normalization factor in the denominator. So this is general, doesn't deal necessarily with the Schrödinger equation. Every time you have a differential equation, you can write an equivalent variational principle. And what it says is that we can throw to this E of psi, to this functional, whatever wave function we want. We can make it psi very simple, very complex. We can concoct anything. And no matter what we concoct, we'll never be able to get an expectation value on the normalized wave function that is lower than the ground state energy E0. And so that's great for a lot of things. We could, just very rudimentally try to solve a quantum mechanical problem, not by solving Schrödinger equation, but by just constructing some parametric wave function, throwing them into the functional and changing the parameters until we minimize that expectation value. And that within that parametric form, will be our best guess for the ground state energy. If we are very good in choosing either a very flexible or a very physical variational form, we are going to be able to actually get very close to the ground state. If we are Robert Laughlin, we can even explain the quantum Hall effect with such an ansatz. But we'll use it in a moment to try and make some progress in solving the Schrödinger equation. A little corollary for a non-degenerate case is also that if the expectation value, that is the functional, gives me exactly the ground state energy that I actually don't know, so it's not super useful, then the wave function psi is the ground state wave function, and vice versa. How do we make progress? So 1925, Schrödinger went skiing in Arosa, came back with the Schrödinger equation. And then Douglas Hartree, that was a chemist at the University of Cambridge, tried to, deal with this complexity of this many-body wave function and said, we are lost, that statement was from him before, even for an iron atom, we have 10 to the 78 variables for a very poor sampling. Let's try to deal with something that is much more numerically, analytically, or computationally tractable. That is, so let's make an ansatz, let's make an hypothesis, and that's an approximate one in general, that this very complex wave function psi can be written actually as the product of n, we call them single particle wave function, phi 1, phi 2, phi n. And you see right away for our iron atom, here with poor sampling, we have to specify 10 to the 78 complex number. What is the complexity here on the right? Well, it's much simpler because, in order to represent phi 1, now we just need 1,000 complex number. And here we have 1,000 complex number, and here we have 1,000 complex number. So we have gone from 10 to the 78 to 26 times 10 to the 3. And the complexity is linear scaling. If I double the size of my system, I double, let's say, the number of electrons in my system, I double the computational complexity, while before it was exponentially exploding. So much, much better, even my cell phone, or maybe even myself with a bit of training, I can deal with 26,000 numbers. So what's the next step? Well, Hartree, was very good at differential equations. We'll see why in a moment. He asks himself, in new functional analysis, what are the conditions that this 26 phi I needs to satisfy such that the so-called functional derivative, I'm assuming here real orbitals for simplicity, that is the change in that functional where the psi is just a product of my 26 orbitals with respect to phi I is equal to zero. So that's a minimum condition. So I know that I have to minimize the energy, I need to minimize that functional from the variational principle, and now I'm asking myself, what are the conditions that the phi I from 1 to 26 needs to satisfy such that the psi that is approximated as a product of those 26 phi I minimizes the variational principles. Well, those 26 conditions are actually 26 differential equations. So Hartree went from one Schrödinger equation on an impossible wave function psi to 26 equations on a Schrödinger-like equation. It's called actually the Hartree equations. They are written here, the Hartree equations, on much, much simpler objects, that is, onto my single particle objects. So what do these Hartree equations tell me is that each electron, phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, satisfy a Schrödinger-like equation where they fill the quantum kinetic energy. They feel the external potential of all the nuclei. And this is the fun term this year. It's called the Hartree operator. If you look at it, you realize what it is. This Hartree operator represents the Coulombic repulsion for electron I coming from all the other electron J. So if I'm electron 1, I see the Coulombic repulsion from all the other 25 electron in an average way. So this is, you know, the probability of finding an electron, in this case, electron J somewhere. So that is the charge density, actually, of electron J. I call it rho J. And here you see rho J divided by the distance. This is the Coulombic potential. So the Hartree operator represents the Coulombic repulsion from every other electron. We have lost in this the concept of correlation, because you see, you suppose for a moment, you know, you, each one of you is one of the 26 electrons in the iron atom. And what we are, you know, starting to study is we study maybe the first of these 26 electrons. What we are looking is at the average repulsion through the charge density, rho J, of every other electron. So suppose, you know, that you are like me sitting on the chair. It doesn't matter if instantaneously you move your arm, because you are not going to act instantaneously on me. We lose the correlation. What only matters is your charge density. So what is your average probability may be taken in these 2 hours. And if I take the average of you over 2 hours, you look as a fuzzy blob. And maybe some of you are already looking as a fuzzy blobs. Okay, so every electron acts in the differential equation to the electron that we are solving for. Here is electron I, through its average probability, that is through its charge density. So what we have gained is that now, rather than having one impossible equation, we have 26, but a much easier equation. Each of them, you know, 10 to the 3 complex numbers rather than 10 to the 78. But it's an approximation. It's not going to be exact. So when it's something is an approximation, we always have to ask, is it good or is it not good? Before going into that, let me make some comments about this 26 equation, because we'll see that over and over again, these equations have become what we say self-consistent. That is, you see, to know what happens to electron I, so if I want to find phi I, I need to know what every electron J does. So I need to have the solution for every other electron to find what electron 1 does. And same for electron 2, I need to know what electron 1 and electron 3 and electron 4. And for electron 3, I need to know what 1 and 2 and 4. So it's, you know, eating its tail, if you want. And that really means that in order to solve for 1, we need to know what is the solution for the others. But to find the solution for the others, we need to know what is the solution for 1. And so typically, we do that by iteration. We start with a guess of what could be a good solution. We start with maybe some fi that are, let me just jump here and then I'll go back, that are some good guesses, maybe what the electrons would do in an atom. With that guess, we build all the different Hartree operators. We solve this equation. With those solutions, we now construct a new set of operators, new equation, we solve it and iterate it. So not only we have gone from one Schrödinger to 26 Hartree, but the 26 Hartree, we have to solve them over and over again. Still much, much better than solving the impossible one. As I said, you know, that the last comment is that this is what is called an independent particle model, because each electron feels what we call an effective potential, a mean field potential, that is just the average effect of the repulsive interaction of the other electrons. Okay, I think this is a good moment to stop for 5 minutes so that you can catch your breath. So we'll start again in 5 minutes. It will be 4 or 5. We briefly see Hartree Fock, and then we go into the theorem of density functional theory. So I'll mute myself for 5 minutes, and maybe I'll mute also my image, and see you in 5 minutes. Okay, welcome back, everyone. So I let you digest the Hartree approach. Now, as I told you, Hartree was very good at differential equation and integral differential equations because he actually studied during World War I how to integrate the complex differential equation of what happens when you throw cannonballs in the presence of friction. So I guess they wanted to throw a cannonball back and forth across the channel. These were a bit too difficult for him, so for that he really needed a computer. Being in 1927, computer technology was still rudimentary. Actually, there were no computers as we understand them now. Computers at the time were mechanical objects. So this is actually a 1927 computer. It's called a differential analyzer. This one was built at MIT, and that's where Hartree went. There were the good computer scientists, you see, at the time, in order to solve its equation. Then in the 1930s, a computer took a different name. A computer became a person that was doing a lot of calculations. And so during the war, in the Second World War, in places like Los Alamos, you would have rooms full of computers that were people trying to solve the equation. Maybe you've seen the movie Hidden Figures. And often, you know, women, as in many other fields, were much better than men at doing this calculation. They were more accurate. And to be on the safe side, there would be two different rooms doing the same calculations twice to make sure that the results was correct. So Hartree goes to the States, takes a boat, solves the Hartree equation, thanks to the differential analyzer that this gentleman here had constructed. His name is Vannevar Bush, no relation with the Bush family. He was one of the great scientists and engineers. And I start lighthearted with this diversion on an article that he wrote in 1945. You see, that was still a World War, at least for Japan and the US, called As We May Think. And I want to mention it here because I think it's actually incredibly remarkable. So no computers, no real, you know, electronic semiconductor valve diode computers in 1945, no semiconductor electronics. But here is Bush saying, you know, the arithmetical machine of the future will perform complex computation at exceedingly high speeds and record results in form to be readily available for distribution or later manipulation. And then mathematics will become effective in bringing the knowledge of atomistics to the solution of problems in chemistry, metallurgy, and biology. You see what it means to have a vision. These days, there are a lot of people that have hallucinations, but Bush had a vision. And now this is fantastic. This is, you know, it says how we will work in the future. And it says we will work with MEMEX. A MEMEX is a device, I think he thought a mechanical device, where we store all our book records and communication. Here is my MEMEX, and which is mechanized. So it may be consulted with exceeding speed and flexibility. It's an enlarged intimate supplement to his memory, for those of you that want to know why DFT is like Tinder. So physically, it's made of a desk. Maybe it can be operated from a distance, but maybe it's a piece of furniture. There are slanting translucent screens. Some materials can be projected for convenient reading. There is a keyboard, sets of buttons and levers. Sadly, I don't have any levers. And now this is amazing. Wholly new forms of encyclopedias will appear, ready-made with a mesh of associative trails running through them. So the chemist, or you know, the scientist, has all the literature before him in his laboratory. They were all male at the time, sadly, with trails following the analogies of compounds and side trails to their physical and chemical behavior. You know, this is Wikipedia, the internet, hyperlinks, all wrapped in once. So I get very excited when I talk about Bush. Vannevar. This is it. He's the guy that created the National Science Foundation in the US, for those of you that are into these things. Let's go back to Hartree. Hartree made a terrible mistake that luckily realized quite soon, not only him, but also Fock in St. Petersburg. Maybe it was already Leningrad at the time, realized. And, he really made, a first-year, whatever, a BA student error. That is, he had forgotten one of the fundamental properties of quantum mechanics, and that's the one where wave function for many electrons have some fundamental symmetry properties. You can derive this from quantum field theory, but basically the property that he had forgotten is that the wave function for the 26 electrons, 2,000 electrons, 2 electrons needs to be totally anti-symmetric. You see, electrons, first of all, are indistinguishable. So swapping one with the other, it shouldn't be distinguishable. But what we have is that when we calculate the expectation values, that swap doesn't necessarily need to lead to an identity. Even a phase, or in this case, a minus one, is also good, because when you take the expectation value, what you get is the same expectation value, because this two minus will cancel out. So he had forgotten to impose this symmetry property that we call total antisymmetry. A good fermionic wave function, that is, for a quantum particle that has a half integer spin, could be a muon. If you swap the two coordinates, you need to change sign. And in passing, we will not look at it. For bosons, it's totally symmetric, so you keep the same sign. And that really makes quantum mechanics for bosons a little bit easier. Suddenly, they're a little bit less interesting. Okay, Hartree didn't lost faith and said, well, I'm going to make a new ansatz. I'm going to approximate my wave function psi, not as a product of single particle orbitals, but something that is still related to single particle orbitals, but rather than being a product, is a sum over all the possible products between all the possible combinations with the right sign, so that the sum is totally antisymmetric. And for those of you that are familiar with linear algebra, you can just do that by writing your ansatz psi as a determinant, where on the column, you see on the first column, we have the first orbital, phi alpha, but as a function of the different electronic variables. So we have 26 vector variables, say for our iron atom, we have 26 orbitals that go from phi alpha, phi beta, phi gamma, up to phi nu, although nu is not the 26th letter in the Greek alphabet, sadly. I don't think the Greek alphabet gets to 26, I forgot, maybe 25. And it's normalized with 1 over the square root of the factorial. You see that very easily for the case of 2 electrons. Suppose that we have 2 electrons, so this is R1 and R2. How do we write that? It's 1 over square root of 2 of phi alpha R1, phi alpha R2, phi beta R1, phi beta R2. And this Slater determinant, J.C. Slater, was a professor at MIT that will come back later on. You see, is just equal to phi alpha R1, phi beta R2, minus phi beta R1, phi alpha R2. So you see it right away that this is totally antisymmetric. If I swap R1 and R2 in this expression, my object changes sign, because basically the first term becomes the second and the second becomes the first. And in general, a determinant does that automatically for all the electrons that you have. And by the way, this is still how we think. If you think at an atom in the periodic table, you're not thinking at the many-body wave function, you're thinking at the single orbitals, the 1s, the 2s, the 2p, and so on and so forth. So you assume that, you know, your many body wave function for the 26 electrons of iron can actually be thought as a Slater determinant of the 26 orbitals, or, you know, 13 spin orbitals of your problem. And by the way, from this, actually, you see right away Pauli's principle, because you know that a determinant is zero if two columns are equal. So suppose that phi alpha is equal to phi beta. I'm not treating spin here to make things a bit simpler, but if phi alpha is equal to phi beta, these two columns are identical, the determinant is zero. So it's one way, sort of hand waving, to say that two electrons cannot sit in the same quantum state. Anyhow, so 1 year has passed, Hartree has been redeemed from his approximate ansatz hypothesis. He has made a better hypothesis, Fock has done the same. And again, now with the, you know, ansatz that psi is a Slater determinant, we go back to the variational principle. So that is still true, and we look at the conditions that the 26 phi I need to satisfy, or let's call them phi lambda, just to use the same notation here. The 26 phi lambda needs to satisfy such that the variational principle is satisfied. So again, you know, we transform one complicated differential equation in 26 differential equation. Actually here, for some reasons that I won't go to, they have the same form. So we actually need to find 26 solution to the same equation. They look a lot like the Hartree equation for each of them. So you see there is a quantum kinetic energy term for, you know, the electron that sits in orbital phi lambda. There is an external potential. There is a Hartree term. You see this is the charge density rho mu. So there is the Coulombic repulsion from all the electrons. But now note the sum is not done on all other electrons, but it's done on all the electrons. So mu here doesn't skip lambda, goes from 1 to 26. So oddly, you would say electron lambda fills also the Coulombic repulsion with itself, because phi lambda in that sum fills the Coulombic repulsion from his own charge density. That's what we would call a self-interaction that become very important on Friday. But in reality, what happens is that in going from Hartree to Hartree-Fock, derivation is much more complex. So we have an extra fourth term that is called the exchange term. So this is now called the Hartree term. Note that the Hartree term in Hartree-Fock is slightly different from the Hartree term in Hartree, because in this sum over mu, in Hartree equation, so we skipped the electron that, you know, we were solving for here. We don't skip it, but actually we have an additional entire term that is called exchange. Is a little bit weird. This is why these are integral differential equations. You see the phi lambda has gone inside the integral, but there is a minus sign, and so that's what's very important. You see that when in this second sum in the exchange term mu is equal to lambda, that cancels out exactly the Hartree self-interaction. So actually the electron doesn't physically interact with itself. It's just that its self-interaction present in the Hartree is actually later on cancelled out by the exchange term. So now these Hartree-Fock equations satisfy this fundamental total anti-symmetry of the wave function, much, much better approximation. And actually, you can do a living out of this. So that is, they are good or very good. They can describe atoms very well. They can describe molecules. Atoms, I think, you know, accurately and extensively were described for the first time by Clementi and Roetti at IBM in the United States in the early 70s. So you could buy, you know, beautiful book of numbers that were the Clementi-Roetti tables with all the Hartree-Fock solutions for the periodic table. And in general, you know, these Hartree-Fock equations are so good that actually you can not only describe, let's say, atoms and molecules quite well, but they can be the starting point for more complex treatment that we will not go into, and that's the entire field of quantum chemistry. You could go into Muller-Plessé perturbation theory. You know, they published on Physical Review, the APS, so they got all those citations, and you have MP2, MP3, MP4. Suddenly, they are not variational, these additions, so you can go below the exact total energy. Here in Hartree, because there is the variational principle, the Hartree-Fock energy is going to be at the very best equal to the exact energy, and in general will be some little bit amount above. So in general, the Hartree-Fock energy will be greater of equal than the exact energy. And actually, we call the difference between these two, this is a definition, the correlation energy. So the correlation energy is the energy that comes from all the beyond Hartree-Fock chemistry that is, in the exact solution, but is not in the Hartree-Fock solution. So, as I said, you could have Muller-Plessé perturbation theory. You could have more complex and very powerful approaches, like a couple of clusters, where you have systematic ways of introducing multi-determinant solution. You could have a full configuration interaction. What sort of makes these techniques beautiful but tricky is that they become very expensive very fast. One quantity that is very important to keep in mind is the order of scaling. And if you take, say, a Hartree-Fock equation, well, we won't go into the detail of why, but it scales as the fourth power of your system size. So it means that if you double the size of your system, you study two iron atoms instead of one, the calculation becomes 16 times more expensive. And more accurate techniques scale as the fifth, the sixth, the seventh power, or maybe even exponentially. So, maybe you can do that very well for 10 electrons, but not all the computers in the world are sufficient for 11 electrons. For DFT, we'll see standard DFT scales as the cube power. We'll see it later. I saw a question popping up. Now, this is also a great equalizer. If something scales as the seventh power, it means that maybe what you can do on your laptop is just a little bit less good than what someone that has the largest supercomputer in the world can do. Maybe you can do 10 electrons and that person can do 11 electrons. But in practice, it's very difficult to treat complex systems with hundreds of electrons with some of these techniques. Although there is a very lively area that I will not go into of quantum chemistry, of better scaling approaches down to linear scaling or even sublinear scaling that try to go towards large sizes. Our dream is to have accuracy and large sizes. So after having said that Hartree-Fock was very good, I say, why do we need something else? Well, the truth is that it's very good, but it's still not good enough for having the kind of chemical accuracy that we want to predict a chemical reaction, to predict material properties. Often, if you were to study a simple elemental metal with Hartree-Fock, it will become an insulator. And so it's, it's very good, but often is not good enough. And that's why I want with this to go into density functional theory, for which today we'll just do the foundations, tomorrow we'll do the practice, and on Friday we'll see what it can be used for and what are its failing. But before going from Hartree-Fock to density functional theory, I want to just give you a little tidbit that I love of a theory that is maybe much less known, but that I find absolutely fascinating. And for that, I need to introduce reduced density matrices. This is, you see, the definition of the first order reduced density matrix. In first quantization, we take the integral of a wave function times its complex conjugate. we integrate around variables from 2 to n, and so we obtain an object that, in this case, the first order reduced density matrix depends only on 2 variables. Of course, you know, because of total antisymmetry, it doesn't matter that we integrate from 2 to n. We could have integrated from 1 to 4, skipped 5, and from 6 to 26. So this is the definition of the first order, and the second order is now a function of 4 variables, and it's obtained in first quantization integrating over all the others minus the first 2 on each side. Look at this very carefully, because, you know, what are the objects that you have learned up to now? You have learned about the many electron wave function. 26 electrons for iron is already impossible to deal with. We have learned about the charge density. This is intermediate, is a function of 2 or 4 variables. So in our old approach, it would take 1 million or 1 English billion of data points to describe this. And it doesn't scale with the size of the system, okay? Or it's a bit like the charge density. If we increase the number of electrons, the number of variables doesn't change. Of course, if we increase the size of the space where this takes place, it increases, but just as the second or fourth power. Now, the beauty of these density matrices is that you can write this expression. So you can write, actually, the total energy of a system in the presence of an external potential. You see, this is the one-body term, and this is the two-body Coulombic term. You can write the total energy of the system as a functional of the first and the second order reduced density matrix. So to get the energy exactly, you don't need the Schrödinger equation. You can just evaluate this functional. And, you can write a variational principle. You can minimize this functional with respect to gamma 1 and gamma 2 and find the ground state energy. So incredibly simple, and it failed, or mostly failed. I mean, I know that there are friends and colleagues working on this. But what is the problem? So of reduced density matrix theory, the problem is that the functional is known, but the domain of definition of gamma 1 and gamma 2 is not. So we know that we have to minimize this functional, but we don't know how to move in the space of gamma 1 or gamma 2. So this is called a representability problem. So we know the functional, but we don't know if we write arbitrary gamma 1 or gamma 2 function of 2 or 4 variables, that is not a physical reduced first or second order density matrix, and in particular, the problem is for the second order reduced density matrix, it's not going to be a valid one. So while defining what is a valid wave function is very simple, it needs to be Lebesgue integrable, you need to be able to integrate a square modulus over all the domain of definition, it needs to be continuous, and so on and so forth. For gamma 1 and for gamma 2 in particular, we don't have the conditions. So remember this, we will not use it, but reduced second order density matrix is a little bit more complex than Hartree-Fock. It has an explicit energy functional, but at variance with Hartree-Fock, the energy here is exact, it has a variational principle, but we don't know where to search. And what we'll do in density functional theory is instead get a theory where it's very easy to search, but we don't know what is the functional. So here we have the functional, we don't know where to search, so we have a representability problem. In density functional theory, you'll see we know that the functional exists, but we don't know what it is. We know how to represent our arguments, it will be the charge density, so we don't have a representability problem, but we just don't have the function. You see, that's life in MRF, everything that you would like. So let's move to DFT, to do that, let me make some statements first. That is how to define some of the concepts and the quantities. Let's go back to Schrödinger. Okay, remember in the Schrödinger equation, the only thing that you need to have to state the problem. Solving it is almost impossible, but stating it is very easy. The Schrödinger equation needs to know what is the external potential, where are your nuclei, and how many electrons we have. If I give you the external potential and the number of electrons, and you are better than Ramanujan, you're going to solve the Schrödinger equation for me. You might not be able, but someone in principle can do it. So the problem is completely well defined. And because the solution of the Schrödinger equation, impossible in practice, but well defined in principle, is there. So we have the wave function, and all the system properties follow from the wave function. What we say is that the energy of a system is a functional in mysterious way through the impossible solution of the Schrödinger equation of the external potential and the number of electrons. Now, I like impossible. Another guy that liked impossible was Enrico Fermi. And Enrico Fermi said, let's actually try to do something where we look for a function of the energy, not as a function of the many-body wave function. It's trivial, psi h psi, but psi is impossible. Not as the second-order reduced density matrix. It's easy to write that energy functional, but we don't know where to search for gamma 1, gamma 2. Fermi didn't know because reduced second-order density matrix theory comes from the 60s. But he said, well, let's try to see, and that was very intriguing, if we can write an expression for the energy as a function L of the charge density. And, he was a theorist, but he was also an experimentalist, and he had a lot of practical sense, as opposed to his friends, Ettore Majorana. And so he said, let's see what matters into quantum mechanics. And he had a feeling, in quantum mechanics, what matters is the curvature, the quantum kinetic energy. What matters is the interaction of the electron with external potential, and what matters is the electron-electron interaction. And he said, let's try to find a functional that is able to construct these three different terms from the charge density alone. Now, what is really difficult, in the electron-electron interaction, a little bit like Hartree had done, one could approximate those with electrostatics in a mean field sense, same with external potential. The quantum kinetic energy is tricky because the quantum kinetic energy is the Laplacian. So it wants to know about the curvature of the wave function. But the charge density has killed the curvature. The charge density, let's take only one electron. The charge density is the square modulus of the wave function. Let's take the most remarkable case, a free electron, an electron that doesn't feel any potential. We know that f of r is a plane wave, e to plus or minus ik dot r. Well, the square modulus of a plane wave is a constant. So the charge density of a free electron is constant because it's free. The charge density, the probability of finding it is equal everywhere. But the second derivative, the curvature of this, if we take, e to the I k dot r in r trees in atomic units, e to the I k dot r, I won't do it for you, but it's just one half k square. So a plane wave can have any kinetic energy in the world. The kinetic energy is one half k square. So if k is very large, the wave length is very small, the kinetic energy, the quantum kinetic energy is huge. If k is very small, the wavelength is very large, the charge density is flat, the quantum kinetic energy is very small. So the charge density has forgotten everything about the quantum kinetic energy. So how can you get the curvature of the wave function from the charge density? You cannot. But of course, Fermi was not going to stop just because of this. And so what it came out with is something that we'll see later, but that we call the local density approximation. And it's a local density approximation for the quantum kinetic energy. So what does our friend here say? Well, suppose that we have a molecule, you know, this is water molecule. Let me actually get some water molecule here, and CO2 also dissolved. So the water molecule actually looks a lot like a sphere, the electronic charge density, I mean, with a little bit of tetrahedral symmetry. And he wanted to, you know, figure out what the kinetic energy of this object is from the charge density. So what he said is this. He said, well, let's suppose that at every point in space, here where the charge density is small, here, here, here. So at every point in space, we can assume that there is a kinetic energy density that is the kinetic energy density of the homogeneous electron gas. So if we take a gas of electrons that don't interact with each other, this is the Sommerfeld model. Okay, so they don't have Coulombic repulsion, they are easy, we can solve them analytically. The only variable is the density or the volume. So we can actually solve that problem and we can write what is the total energy of that system, that is the kinetic energy, because they don't interact, they are in a flat potential, it's homogeneous. And that kinetic energy density goes as the power 5/3 of the density. And the LDA is here. This is the LDA. What Fermi does with his student Thomas is that he constructs an energy functional, the Thomas Fermi functional, where we have simple terms. Let me start from the last one. This is a Hartree term, is the charge density electrostatic interaction with itself. This is the interaction of the electronic charge density with the external potential. And it says for the difficult term, for the first term, for the quantum kinetic energy, what I do is let me use for the first time today different colors. I'll use green. We, you know, slice up space. So the energy density here is going to be 0, here is going to be 1, in some units 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 3, 2, 1. And so in every one of these infinitesimal little cubes, I have a charge density rho. And if that infinitesimal cube was part of the non-interacting homogeneous electron gas, we would know what would be its contribution to the total kinetic energy of the system. That would be also the contribution to the total energy, would just be the kinetic energy density, A times rho to the 5/3, times the volume of that infinitesimal cube, that is d of r dr. So Fermi integrates over all space, over all volume, the charge density to the 5/3, because it associates to every infinitesimal cube a density that corresponds to the, sorry, it associates a kinetic energy that corresponds to the kinetic energy of that little infinitesimal cube of the homogeneous electron gas. Okay, very smart. Now we have a functional, you see it, of the charge density alone. So you throw in the external potential, you minimize this function with respect to rho, linear scaling. So if you double the number of electrons in the same volume, nothing changes computationally because you deal only with rho. If you double the size of your system, well, maybe the last integral scale as the square, but it's easy to sort that out. Does it work? Well, you know, it's a little bit like Hartree. You see, there is the external, the Hartree. Kinetic energy looks not as good. And in reality, it works even worse than the Hartree approach. What is good is that it's, as I said, inexpensive. It introduced the concept of depending on the charge density. Dirac, that was very smart and half Swiss, said, well, why don't we also add relativistic effects, sorry, exchange effects through the, again, exchange energy that we could calculate just from that exchange term. But the truth is that, sadly, it didn't work very well. If you take, say, the charge density profile of this is, you know, integrated already onto spherical shells for the argon atom, Hartree Fock, you know, does a very good job in getting the shell structure of the atom. Thomas Fermi, with the Dirac extension and with the Weizsäcker expansion of the kinetic energies in perturbative orders, you know, they just get more or less the right shape, but you know, so it's not a total failure, but is very far away from getting the true physics or chemistry of the system. So great idea, it just doesn't work. So these were the 30s, and so now we have to jump. So Hartree Fock gets established, Hilleras, with a lot of computer that were people doing calculations, you know, gets the energy to incredible accuracy using the variational principle. It gets, you know, the energy of the helium atom, two electrons, impossible to solve analytically, down to an incredible number of digits, getting the 99.9% of the correlation energy with variational forms that are very, very flexible. And so that seems, you know, the way to go. Now let's skip to the 60s. Walter Cohn here looking very smug, having escaped the Nazis, first in England, then to Canada, then to the States, goes in 1964 on sabbatical to Paris. And that's, I think, you know, one of the important messages. You need to go ideally on holiday, but in nice places. Schrödinger went skiing, got the Schrödinger equation. Walter Cohn goes to Paris. I think he got the Basque, and he got the Hohenberg and Cohn theorems. I don't know what he liked most. Sadly, he passed away four years ago. But there, with a lot of time in his hands, starts thinking, and together with his friend Pierre Hohenberger, that is now at Yale, they develop 1964, 1965, and publish these two theorems. And so now we get to the heart of today's webinar. You know, Fermi had the idea, but it was hand-waving. Walter Cohn does the theorems. And he says this. We know already that the external potential and the number of electrons, you know, determine what the Schrödinger equation is. That is, they determine, at least in principle, what are the solution of the Schrödinger equation, what is the ground state wave function. From the ground state wave function, we can get the charge density. So in practice, it might be difficult, but conceptually, it's very easy and very clear. From external potential and the number of electrons, we get the charge density. Walter Cohn demonstrates the vice versa. He demonstrates that if you have the ground state charge density, that determines uniquely, trivially, the number of electrons because you just integrate it, but it determines uniquely the external potential it comes from, that is, the external potentials that thrown into the Schrödinger equation gives you a ground state wave function that gives you the charge density. This is essential because, you know, now there is a one-to-one correspondence. We don't have to talk about the potential, the external potential and the number of electrons to fully specify our quantum mechanical problem. We can talk about the ground state charge density. It's as good as an identification of our problem because there is a one-to-one correspondence. If there is a one-to-one correspondence, I can talk about my left hand or I can talk about my right hand that you probably see reversed unless you are behind me, no one behind. And so they are interchangeable and equally fundamental variables. How does it demonstrate? I won't go through the proof. It's very, very simple. This is in, you know, the way it was originally done. There are more elegant maybe formulation of density functional theory that are based on Lieb proof. More recently here, it needs to still introduce a representability condition for the charge density that is called the V representability. That is, says it needs to be a charge density for which there is an external potential of which this is a ground state charge density. It turns out, as opposed to reduced density matrix second order theory, that these representability conditions might be maybe difficult to formulate, but in practice are not a problem. Again, I will not go through the proof of this one-to-one correspondence, but is a proof ad absurdum. It says that if there wasn't a one-to-one correspondence, you see, it's very simple. You know, any of us could have come up with this. Sadly, you know, it was done already. But it's very, very simple. It says if there wasn't this one-to-one correspondence, we would get to an absurdum that, you know, these two energies should be different and equal at the same time. And that's, you know, the agony and the ecstasy of the entire problem, that is, we focus for a moment on a much simpler quantity like the charge density, but we don't really have a prescriptive theorem. We have an absurdum theorem that just tells us that this one-to-one correspondence is true, but it doesn't give us any tool to actually work out in practice how we could do this. Not that it would be useful, because even if we were able to build the, you know, external potential of which a charge density is the ground state, it would be still impossible to solve the Schrödinger equation. But the first step was done. The density has, you know, become a legitimate quantity in quantum mechanics, is the basic variable. One-to-one correspondence with the external potential, it's equally good. Now, the second theorem. We are getting that. To do that, what Walter Cohn and Pierre Hoiberg do is that they define a functional. And this is, you know, the functional of the density, of density functional theory. And it's a universal functional because it's a functional that depends only on the charge density. You give it the charge density, it gives you this number. How do they define this? It's defined like this as it's written. For a given charge density, N of R, we know that in principle, the external potential and the number of electrons is uniquely determined. So we have the Schrödinger equation in principle. We can solve it in principle. We can get the ground state wave function psi in principle, and we can calculate the expectation value on that ground state wave function of the quantum kinetic energy operator and of the electron-electron two-body interaction operator. It's all well-defined. Charge density, thanks to the first Hoiberg and Cohn theorem, gives me the external potential, the number of electrons. I have a well-defined Schrödinger equation. I have a well-defined wave function in the ground state. I take this expectation value, psi, TeV, psi, and this is a number, f. This number is a functional of the charge density, N of R. Having defined this universal functional f of n, Cohn, with his Basque, I don't know what he was doing in Paris, I think I know what Schrödinger was doing in Arosa, writes out one more term in the functional. So he writes an additional term that is just the integral of the external potential times the charge density. So the universal functional f plus this external potential is, again, a functional. Universal f plus integral of external times n. And it proves, and that's super simple, we'll get to that in a moment, that this functional e, that is a functional of the charge density n, and you need to know what the external potential is through the charge density n, is always greater or equal than the ground state charge density. So you can minimize this object with respect to n, and get, if you are at the exact minimum of this object, the ground state charge density. So this is a miracle. He has rewritten quantum mechanics, not as a Schrödinger equation. So this is, again, 1964. It's quantum mechanics, not a la Schrödinger, but a la Kohn, as an exact variational principle. You minimize this thing with respect to all the possible n, you get the ground state charge density. The proof of this is very simple because, again, if you take the ground, you know, the charge density determines the external potential, it determines its ground state wave function. That ground state wave function can be taken inside the expectation value of psi h psi, and you have exactly the integral of rho times v external. Sorry, this should be an n times v external f of n. Great. So what are the good things? We have an exact reformulation of the ground state energy as the minimum of the functional that you see. It's super simple. The only catch is that we don't know what f is. That's a little bit of a big catch, actually, because if we don't know what f is, we can't do anything. And in fact, not much, to be honest, was done until the late 70s. We'll come to that in a moment. But I guess like Fermi, you know, Kohn was not one to stop at such a small detail. And, you know, in this, what happened is that he had a brilliant postdoc. He just graduated in Cambridge, University of Cambridge. That's the Cambridge that is in the UK. Lou Shum did a PhD in the Cavendish Laboratory. It was a great time. Brian Josephson was there, Fulkerheine was there, P.W. Anderson was there. Anyhow, he goes to San Diego, joins Kohn, and you know, Walter Kohn tells him, "Well, I have a variational principle. What do we do? You know, we have said to now that once we have a differential equation, we build a variational principle. We can go back and forth. If we have a variational principle, we can build a differential equation." This is, you know, the Euler and Lagrange equations that correspond to the variational principle. The only catch is that we don't know, you know, the small detail that I didn't tell you before hiring you for your postdoc. So always ask for what you will do for your postdoc. And if your supervisor knows what you will do, it means it's not a very good idea. Walter Kohn didn't know and says, well, do something with it. And so they came up with this barking mad idea. That works maybe because they were, you know, very bright, very brave, or they were also very lucky. You know, the history of good things is always a combination of intuition and luck. So what do? Well, they say, let's talk about some objects that are not real electrons. We'll call them Kohn-Sham electrons. Okay, you can do whatever you want. So they christen this object Kohn-Sham electrons. These Kohn-Sham electrons are distant cousins of the real electrons. That's why they are in light blue here. They live on the moon or on Mars or wherever in outer space. And in particular, these electrons do not interact. It's very depressing if you're an electron or not interacting, so they can pass by and not feel each other. But the definition of the Kohn-Sham electron is that, they will live in an external potential that we call the Kohn-Sham potential, where these non-interacting electrons, for which is, because they are non-interacting, is very simple to do a lot of stuff. There are no two-body terms. In that Kohn-Sham potential, their ground state charge density is going to be identical to the charge density of the interacting system. So I take my water molecules, 8 valence electrons, 10 electrons all together. Suppose that I had solved the Schrödinger equation, I know what is the exact charge density of my 10 interacting electrons in the field of the protons on the oxygen nucleus, the 8 protons, and then one proton for the hydrogen and another proton for the other hydrogen. Okay, now what we say is that this was the ground state of the true electrons interacting with each other in the field of the external potential. Now we build a different external potential that we call the Konechan potential. So the Konechan electrons that don't interact in that Konechan potential, they have a ground state charge density that is identical to the charge density of the interacting system. Why is it great to introduce these poor cousins living on the moon that are pathetic and non-interacting? Well, because they are, you know, they might be pathetic and non-interacting, but they are smarter than the Fermi charge density, because you can still take a second derivative of a non-interacting electron and get something out of it. And so really this entire trick is to be, you know, to find a better way to guess what the quantum kinetic energy of the system was. So remember, you know, we started with the total functional, that is f of n that we don't know, plus the external potential, the integral times n. And we try to make sense of this. And exactly like Fermi did, you know, he sort of broke down f in three parts: kinetic energy, for which he did a local density approximation, Hartree, and external potential electrostatic. They also do a breakdown of this f functional in three parts. So they have something that they don't know, f of n, and they break down into three parts, of which two are well defined, and the third one is what is left. So it almost looks like a, you know, Las Vegas casino trick. You have something that you don't know, and they say, well, you know, now this something that you don't know is going to be equal to A plus B plus C, and I know what A and B is. But if I don't know what C is, one could say I haven't made any progress. So, you know, maybe A is an elephant, B is a car, and, you know, C needs to be the difference between the iron atom and the elephant and the car. So it's not much progress, but, you know, they were very smart, and, you know, they were capturing into A and B a lot of the physics and a lot of the chemistry of the system. And so what they did is say, well, you know, what we are going to do, we are not going to do the local density approximation for the quantum kinetic energy, but we are going to say that, you know, F is broken apart, the F of the true interacting electrons, into three parts, where the first part is the kinetic energy of the impostors, so the fake electrons on the moon, the non-interacting electrons. We call that a TS. It's very well defined for a charge density. We don't know yet what the Konechan potential is, but if we have the Konechan potential, it's trivial. You know, actually, for non-interacting electrons, a Slater determinant is an exact solution. You can try it. And so that expression for non-interacting electrons is perfectly well defined. It's not the true kinetic energy of the system, is not the T calculated on the exact ground state wave function. It's the TS, same name, but something different. It's like pizza. For those of you that have eaten pizza in Naples and pizza in Chicago, same name, but two completely different things. T and TS, same thing. But, you know, the kinetic energy TS, the Chicago pizza, was sort of getting at least the shape, the thickness of the right pizza. So they have a well-defined TS. They say the second term, we call it the Hartree energy. And then, so what we have done is the game of the three cards. F, that we didn't know, is equal to TS, that is well-defined, Hartree energy, that is well-defined, and everything else that we don't know. So they've just shifted everything that we don't know into the third term, and they call the third term, very evocatively, the exchange correlation energy. Okay, so now forget for a moment that we don't know what this exchange correlation energy is, but if we write the total energy functional that Walter Cohn had written, you see the first three terms, the TS, the kinetic energy of the impostors, the heart rate energy and the exchange correlation energy, that is the part that we don't know, they represent F that we didn't know, and V external times N is what is in the second Hohenbergian quantum. We have made no progress. We have just shifted things around, and then when you get distracted, I'll put in the, you know, the piece that is missing. So we have a functional, explicit. Now you see we have the Cohen-Sham impostors. Here they are. Let me write it. I'm done in 2 or 3 minutes. So these are the Cohen-Sham impostors. But we can take a second derivative of these impostors. So they grab, you know, a quantum kinetic energy much better than the charge density on Thomas Fermi was doing. And again, if we have the energy functional, we can do the Euler-Lagrange equation. This would be the Euler-Lagrange equation for the original energy functional, where we have just kept F. If we decompose F in these three terms, the TS, the external interaction with the external potential, and the Hartree energy. So if we put those three terms in this Euler-Lagrange differential equation here, what we get is what are actually called the Cohen-Sham equation. These are just the Euler-Lagrange equation that corresponds to the differential principle. It's all well defined. You know, lo and behold, there is a Laplacian Cohen-Sham orbital by Cohen-Sham orbital, impostor by impostor, a Hartree potential that is the functional derivative of the Hartree energy, an exchange correlation potential, that's the mystery, you know, it's the functional derivative with respect to the charge density of that exchange correlation energy that we don't know. So we don't know this, so we haven't made any progress, we have just write something, but at least it's formally correct, and the external potential. So you see, we have a bit like in Hartree-Fock, you know, for the iron atom, we have 26 equations that we need to solve, or the same equation for which we need to find 26 solutions. It's just we don't know what to do for this exchange correlation.